The Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, think about this. God could do anything and create anything he wanted, and any way he wanted, in any way. I wonder if you've ever thought and asked yourself, well, if God could do anything he wanted, why? And I'm not proposing that we can always enter the mind of God, but why did God decide to make humans in two different forms, male and female? I mean, there are self-pollinating trees. There are things that, but almost all animals he made into male and female. Dogs, cats, cows, horses, they're all male and female. But, you know, the Bible doesn't say that about them like it says that about man. It doesn't say that. If you notice first chapter of Genesis, it just talked about he made the living creatures, he made the animals, he placed them, and it says then he had them come out of the earth, he brought forth the, you know, the yielding trees and so on, the waters, and he made, and he placed them on the expanse, he talks about that. And God let them, the waters teem. He created the great and the monsters and living things, moose and so on. God blessed them, saying all the things, the cattle and so on, living creatures after their kind. He told them to make after their kind. But I don't find any place where he called them male and female. And then he said in verse 26, then God said, let us make man. And the Hebrew word man is the Hebrew word Adam. Adam. Let us make Adam in our image, according to our likeness. And then what he says next, and let them, Adam is them, let them rule over the fish of the seas, over the birds of the sky, over the cattle, over all earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Verse 27, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. They're made in the image of God, male and female. He blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So men and women are supposed to rule over the earth. They are the undisputed rulers of the earth, over all animals. I've seen women trainers, they've trained tigers, they've done this, they've done, you know, trained seals, and I've seen men trainers. They rule over everything, birds, fish, everything. Now, we have to ask the question why, but let's take a look at one other thing. I want to show you that man, Adam, is male and female. The word Adam is used for male and female. Look at Genesis chapter 5. You have to read this closely, but most of us have read it, maybe never thought about it like this. But Genesis chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man. Now, most translations say man, but the Hebrew word is the same as Adam. This is the book of the generations of Adam, or man, in the day when God created Adam, or man. He made him in the likeness of God. He created them, male and female. And he blessed them. I want you to notice that next phrase. He blessed them and named them Adam, or man. He blessed them and named them. The male and the female were named Adam in the day when they were created. Okay? So male and female are Adam, according to the scripture. Genesis 6 and verse 1. Now it came about when Adam began to multiply the men on the face of the land. Of course, that's men and women. And daughters were born to them. So daughters are part of the Adam. They were the men that were born. In chapter 6 and verse 5, this is Genesis chapter 6, verse. Then the Eternal saw that the wickedness of Adam, man, wicked, was great on the earth. That's men and women were wicked, not just men wicked. Men and women were wicked. And that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. The Eternal, it was only evil continually. The Eternal was sorry that he had made Adam, man, on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And the Eternal said, I will blot out Adam, man, whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals, to creeping things, to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. I'm sorry I did it this way. Now, you know, that's a pretty anthropomorphic understanding. So that we, you know what I mean by anthropomorphic? We try to take God and try to reduce God into a way that we can understand God. Can we understand why God was so upset and he was sorry? Now, he didn't repent of it. But now we have to ask the question, why male and female? He could have made so that men could, or one person, women could self-pollinate, and you know, they just have children. It would be a man, a combination of man and woman, and have without the other person. You don't need another person. And have you noticed, you have your little family, you know, a husband and wife, they get married. Then they have their little children, their kids, and it's our little family. That family, like an Adam, I don't mean A-D-A-M, I mean A-T-O-M. An atom splits apart. It begins to split. It begins to grow. Your children grow up. They marry. They have somebody else come into the family. They marry somebody else. And those people, and that's your children, along with somebody else's child, has children. Now, you have two sets of grandparents, right? You had two parents, but now you have four grandparents. And how many great grandparents do you have? You have eight great grandparents, and you have 16. It goes on and on. How many great grandparents? And so eventually, you know, that's why we know that we are all interacted in some place where we're all the same person is the same person to that person as to you, you know. You look at somebody and they're so-and-so's grandpa. I would go to my grandfather and I thought he was my grandfather. But no, he was also my cousin's grandfather and that's grandfather, and his grandfather, this person. So families grow and they split apart. You have to bring in other people. Other people come into your life. You get to meet in-laws and outlaws and other kinds of laws. And you're meeting these people. God evidently created humans to be, I would say absolutely. He absolutely created humans to be in a relationship with one another. Getting along. Loving. Forgiving. Caring. After all, God himself is love. Doesn't it say that? And what is God doing? But inviting us as sons and daughters into his family. Expanding his family. Independent unity can be very deep in the human family. And in the spiritual family, I don't mean independent, I mean interpersonal. Interpersonal unity can be very deep. People can learn to love one another very deeply. Between men and women, interpersonal unity reaches its zenith when they become husband and wife, as the two people become one. That's the greatest of all the unities. But, you know, the church has unity. People love each other in the church. They find love and care, and they care for one another. We see this in the book of Genesis, chapter 2. The man said, after God created woman, "This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman." I mean, extracted from man, "because she has been taken out of man. For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." It's for this cause. It's because they're male and female. It's because of that they have to be joined to one another. And God has created in us the desire for mating, the desire to be together, the desire to be loving to one another. He's created that in us. Now, Jesus, when he was on the earth, Pharisees came to Jesus. You'll recall this. This is Matthew. Jesus quotes this very same thing. Let's go to Matthew chapter 19. Some Pharisees came to Jesus, testing him and asking him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? He doesn't like the way she cooks. He doesn't like the way she, you know, cleans the house. He doesn't like the way she plants the garden. Can he divorce his wife for any reason at all?" And what does Jesus do? Verse 4, he answered and said, "Have you not read that he which made them, that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female?" Now he's quoting that scripture in Genesis chapter 2. And he said, for this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Have you not read that? He's reading now. He's going back. So now, verse 5. And then Jesus ends, "So they are no longer two, but one flesh." Jesus is adding this now. This is not what Genesis says. These are Jesus' words. "So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate or pull apart." They can't be separated. You cannot be. And then Jesus said, verse 7. This is Matthew 19, verse 7. Then they said to him, "Well, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and then send her away?" Just write out, you have to say, give her a certificate saying she can go. They had copies of certificates, and they tell you how to do it. "I'm releasing you. I have no more claim on you. You can go and be somebody else's wife. I'm sending you out. Get out." Why did Moses tell us to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? Here's Jesus' answer. He said, "Because of the hardness of heart." The hardness of heart. "Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way." Now notice what Jesus does. He skips over Moses. You see that? He didn't go with Moses. Well, why did Moses tell us to do that? Jesus said, Moses did it because of, and I want to deal with this word hardness, okay? Hardness of heart. Now, if you'll remember, I had a sermon several years ago on the hardened of heart. They saw a miracle, the disciples saw a miracle, and then they asked Jesus, "Well, what about bread? Are we going to do any bread?" And Jesus says, "Are you Are you hard? Is your heart so hard you can't learn from this? And the Greek word there is a hardened heart is poros, P-O-R-O-S. Means stone-like. Like, you know, concrete, block you, it doesn't sink in. It's not going very far. It doesn't stamp into your brain. You don't remember it. You don't stamp it. You know, when you can't stamp it, you got to harden. Your brain is hard, poros. But this is not that word. This is not hardness in the way of poros. This is a different word. This is scleros. And in this case, it's a sclerocardia. That's the Greek word. Sclerocardia, a hardened heart. And that word scleros is different from the word poros. Okay? Scleros meant an unyielding frame of mind. Hardness, coldness, obstinacy, stubbornness. Okay? It's different from poros, which meant a hardened heart that doesn't learn. Scleros, I'm reading now from the Artin Gingrich lexicon. Artin Gingrich lexicon. I want to explain it again. The Artin Gingrich lexicon is considered to be one of the best definitions of Greek words. And the reason is they took a guy by the name of Walter Bauer, who was a German, and he did a German study. He had an idea. What if we could get all of the literature, all of the rocks and different things that people wrote on back then, vellum and this and that, and in the time of the New Testament, from maybe a 50 or 100 years before and 100 years after or 200 of the New Testament, in the time of Jesus, and we could see how that word was used in all the various ways in which other people at that time used that word. And we would assume that the apostles were using the word the same way in that period of time. So that's what they did. They found all these places where that particular word was. So here's how they determined scleros. In the Artin Gingrich lexicon, scleros and Artin Gingrich are people, the two scholars who translated Walter Bauer's lexicon into English. So it's the Walter Bauer Artin Gingrich translation. Okay. So scleros meant pertaining to externally hard or rough. Hard to the touch. It's hard to the touch. Rough to the touch. The second definition is pertaining to causing an adverse reaction because of being hard or harsh. A harshness. Now here's one place where scleros is used. John chapter 6 and verse 60. Read it with me if you have a Bible. Remember, Jesus is going along. They have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. If you don't drink my blood, then you have no life in you. You remember that? The statement he's talking to his disciples. In verse 60, John 6, verse 60, on hearing it, many of the disciples said, "This is a scleros teaching. This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it? This is hard. This is difficult. This is almost offensive. It's so hard that it's almost impossible to accept." So it's difficult, and you can see the word scleros means difficult to the point of being impossible. Here's an example. You remember when Paul was on the road, he had fire and brimstone was coming out of him. He wanted to persecute everyone, every Christian. He would get them and throw them in the jail as much. He was so fiery against the Christians. And finally, you remember, he was knocked down on the road to Damascus and so on. And Jesus appeared. Now, in chapter 26 of the book of Acts, Paul is describing this event. I'm going to just read verse 14. Acts 26 and verse 14. "And when we had all fallen to the ground," Paul says, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew dialect, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Now they translated this all into Greek now. It is hard, skleros, for you to kick against the goads. And a goad was a sharp spear-like pointed stick. They take a stick and they would cut it so that it had a point. And what they would do, if you want to get your oxen and your sheep and your, they'd give it a jab, you know, get going, you know, you want to herd these cows and or sheep or goats, and you'd give them a little jab in the rear end with it, with this pointed stick, and it would, they would go. But it's hard to kick against that because you're going to bloody your sandals, bloody your legs, bloody your ankles. And he says, it's hard for you to kick against the goads, meaning almost impossible, hard to the point of being impossible. That's another definition of skleros. It's used here in Acts 27, 26 and verse 14. It also means pertaining to everything, pertaining to being unyielding, unyielding in behavior or attitude. I mean, very hard. This guy is very hard. He's strict. He's harsh. He's cruel. He's merciless. Skleros. And you see it in the book of Matthew, where in the parable, the one guy who gets the talent, remember, he gets this, God, you know, Jesus gave this parable of the talents, saying, man went on the talent, he gave his servants talents, each one according to his ability. To one he gave 10, to one he gave 5, and to the other one he gave 1. And the guy that had 1 went and buried it. He didn't want to do anything with it. He didn't want to lose it. He didn't want to lose it. He didn't want to do any kind of risky. No risk. He doesn't want any risk. Well, if you don't have any risk in life, how are you going to make it? How are you going to do anything in life if you have to absolutely live totally safe with no risk? Life has risks. So in the book of Matthew, chapter 24 and verse chapter 25, this is Matthew 25, parable of the talents, and verse 24, he came back, and the one who had received the one talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, a skleros anthropos. You're skleros. You know, you're mean. You're strict. You're harsh. You're cruel. You're rough, man. Reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. You know, you gather where you didn't even scatter the seed. And here's what they said. So Jesus is talking to these Pharisees. He's saying, and they said, well, why did Moses tell us to give her a bill of divorcement then? And Jesus said, because of the hardness of your hearts, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, how do you divorce? How could Adam divorce? I think, well, I'm divorcing you, Eve. Let's see. Now, who will I marry if I divorce you? Nobody. You're the only woman on earth. So what are you going to do? Now, there's an advantage to Adam and Eve. They had no in-laws. They had no outlaws, no other laws, no other place of people around. They didn't have to learn customs. You know, even in the same race, in the same culture, you know, in the same place, each individual family develops their own little traditions, little ideas, the way they do things. I'll give you an example. When I had breakfast with my wife's family, I saw her father when he was served eggs. He took his knife and his fork and he cut up all the eggs. Even if they were sunny side up or anything, or over easy, he would just cut them up. Cut all of them up, mix the yolk with the white and all that. He would just cut it all up and then he would eat it with his fork pretty much like that, and had a little piece of bread and he would just eat it that way. That's not the way our family did it. When you get the eggs, you punctured the yolk and you used your bread to dip some of the yolk out and stuff like that, and you ate the yolk through your bread. And you know, we did it like that. I watched her father do it. That wasn't my custom. But you know, over the years, I tried it the way her father did it. And the other day, Molly saw me cutting my eggs up, and she said, "That's the way my dad always did it." I said, "Yeah, it has its advantages. If you don't want to eat too much bread, you can just take your fork and eat it." So people have different customs, even in the same culture, even the same race, even the same nationality. Each family will have its own little traditions and little customs, and even though they're different. Italians, you know, this Italian family is not the same as that Italian family, and so on. They all have different little traditions, the way they do things. And part of that, as you get to know that person, you get to become acquainted. So Jesus said, you know, Moses permitted you. From the beginning, this was not so. He skips over and goes all the way back to the beginning. And then he says in verse 9, this is Matthew 19, "And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality," the Greek word is porneia, it means all kinds of sexual sins, "and marries another woman commits adultery," except for that. Now, I want you to notice that Jesus skips. Now, he also did that regarding the Sabbath day. He skips over Moses, okay? Let's give you an example here. This is Mark chapter 2, verse 23. Mark chapter 2. "And it happened that he was passing through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples began to make their way along while picking the hearts of the grains." You know, you have some grains, whether it's barley or wheat, you know, they just pick it up and they shuck it like this and put the grains in there soft. Some of them are soft, some of them are hard already, but you can hold them in your mouth. And the wheat berries or the rye or barley. And so they began to pick the heads of the grain. "The Pharisees were saying to him, 'Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?'" Now there is a specific law that says you cannot on the Sabbath either sow grain or harvest grain. You cannot harvest, no harvesting on the Sabbath. They said that's harvesting. They're doing what is not lawful. Jesus did not say it is too lawful. He didn't say that. But he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need? Now, the Pharisees could argue against that. Your disciples are not in need. They're not going to die. They're not in a war. They're not fighting a battle to save Israel. David did it, but they, you know, your disciples are doing what is plainly not lawful according to the scriptures." And he said, "And his companions were hungry, how he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar the high priest and ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for anyone to eat except the priests. And he also gave it to those who were with him." Jesus said to them in verse 27, now listen, "The Sabbath was made for man." Now where did he go? He went clear over Moses, all the way back to the beginning. Skipped all of those laws and all those, all the way. "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." I've talked to people who are so strict, they turn their whole lives around because the sun is setting and everything has to, you know, they have to, you know, I've heard ministers tell you, "Now when the sun gets setting, you should be in your chairs, everybody in their chairs and greeting the Sabbath and doing, because, you know, you got to stop everything." And Jesus skipped over that. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. How many laws did God give Adam when he created the Sabbath? This is the Sabbath day. This is holy. God rested on the Sabbath day, and he said, you know, to keep it holy. How many laws did he give Adam? How many things did he tell Adam to do on the Sabbath or forbid Adam to do on the Sabbath? Well, in the book of Genesis, you can't find any of those. All the laws, all the do's and don'ts, all the absolute stuff came afterward. Okay, in the book of Malachi, let's go back to husband and wife now. In the book of Malachi, the union between a husband and wife was so serious, this is what God says. He's upset with the people. And in the book of Malachi, dropped him down to chapter 2 and verse 14. Yet you say, in other words, you say, I'm upset with you. Yet you say, for what reason? Why are you upset with us? And God says, because the Eternal has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. By covenant. The marriage is a covenant relationship. It is more than, just a, you know, natural union. It's a covenant. Each person, you know, kind of gives a statement, a vow. And we call them marriage vows, right? What do we call them? A marriage vow. I vow to you. It's a covenant relationship. But no one has done so who has a remnant of the Spirit. And what did, I think I've got my notes, I hope I got them right. Yeah, that's Malachi. Malachi, he goes, says, the wife of your covenant, okay? And verse 15 of Malachi, but not one has done so, has a remnant of the Spirit. And what did that one do while he was seeking a godly offspring? Take heed to your spirit, and let no one deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. Verse 16, for I hate divorce, says the Eternal, the God of Israel, and him who covers his garment with wrong. I hate two things. I hate divorce, and I hate the person who covers his garment with wrong, says the Eternal of hosts. So take heed to your spirit, that you do not deal treacherously. So here we have God speaking. He created us male and female. He created us so that for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother, join to his wife. It implies both people are old enough, strong enough, mature enough to leave parents. You can't be a little boy, a little girl, need your parents. You can't be in, you know, well, I have to have my parents with me. I have to have my, well, you're not ready to be married if you have to have your parents, you know, guide you and all that. All right. Marriage becomes, from Paul's point of view, a picture of the church. In Ephesians chapter 5, after telling the husband and wife that to be subject one to another, in verse 22. Then in verse 23, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church. He tells later in verse 22, wives, be subject to your husbands. But then he says, because the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of the water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having a no spot, wrinkle, or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. For who loves his own wife also loves himself. For no one has hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason, now notice verse 31, Paul now comes down to the same thing. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So once again, we're going back to Genesis. This mystery is great, but I am speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, even though I'm speaking in this great spiritual way, nevertheless, Each individual among you also is to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife see that she respects her husband. So there's the statement. Now, again, you talk about, well, what does that mean, submit? What does that mean, head of? What do you mean when you say the husband is the head of the wife? What does it mean when a wife is supposed to submit? Now, I'll tell you what. It's easy to submit to anyone who would love you as much as Christ loves the church. It would be very easy to do. Because now you know that all things that the person is doing is going to be for your benefit, for your goodness, and loving you so much and caring for you that everything is going to be done in a way just like Christ loved the church. He loved it, gave himself up for her. He'd die for her, do this. He wants the church to be well and cleansed and glorious and everything. That's easy to submit to a person like that. Easy. It's the kind of people that are, I want it my way because I'm selfish kind of thing. That's not easy to do, and wives see that. Anybody can see that. If you're just a selfish person, are you going to use your position only for quote rulership so that you can rule over, so you can have it your way, so you can decide what you want because you want it your way? Okay. Now we're going to come to a passage here to talk about the head, because Jesus is the head of the church, right? As the husband is the head of the wife. Now, years ago, I conducted I think I've mentioned this several times, but I want to say it again. I conducted a class in marriage counseling class for pastors. And all the pastors were there, and I said, you know, the husband is the head of the wife. Now, I want to know what you think the head of the wife means. What does that mean? You can just say the words. I say the words, the husband is the head of the wife. What does that mean in behavioral terms? So I stood at the board and wrote down everything that they said. Give me an idea. Well, one said, that means he earns the living. He provides for his wife, okay? Provides for his wife. Well, another one said, that means he makes the decisions. Okay, he makes all the monetary decisions. He's the boss when it comes to this, and you know, and he's this and he's that. We put in all that. He protects his wife. He has to be the protector. He has to be able to fight for his wife. He's strong. He protects his wife. All these things. All these things were. I wrote down everything that they said on a blackboard. And then I said, well, let's go over them. You know, if you say the definition of the head of the wife, it means he earns the living. What if he's out of a job and his wife takes a job and she's earning the living? Is he still the head of his wife? They all, oh, well, I see. See, if you give it that definition, then he's no longer the head of the wife because you're saying he has to earn the living. Well, oh, he has to be stronger than his wife. Well, what if he's not stronger? What if he has multiple sclerosis, or maybe he has some other disease, emphysema, or and he's not physically stronger than his wife? What if his wife is a karate expert and he's not? What, is he still the head of his wife? Oh, they were, oh, they don't know. Well, he makes the decisions. Well, what if he can't make, what if his wife is better at math and better at doing the books, and better at taking care of the bank accounts, and better at taking care of the money than he is? Is he still the head of the wife? So what we did, when we write down each one of these statements, we said, I said, you see, once when you start defining the head of the wife by behavioral terms of authority and power and strength of person, you have destroyed that definition. Now I'm going to say he's the head of the wife whether he earns the living or not. He's the head of the wife, whether he is stronger, able to protect her. He's the head of the wife, whether he lets her make decisions. She's better at making the decisions about this or that in the home. He's the head of the wife. And it doesn't matter what the behavioral thing, he's still the head of the wife. Well, they were all, so some of them so misunderstood, they couldn't get this concept. So guess what they did? They went out of my class telling everybody David Antion does not believe the husband is the head of the wife. I said, it's the very opposite. I said he's the head of the wife, no matter what. I said that. But they went on, oh, David Antion doesn't believe he's the head of the wife. The question is, what does head mean? What does head mean? Now, here's the passage. Let's read this passage from 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 3. Chapter 11 and verse 3. But I want you to understand that Christ, Christos, anointed one, is the head of every man. Now I want you to look at that very closely. Does that say he's the head of every Christian man? Does it say he's the head of every brother in the church man? Does it every believer man? It says he is the head of every man. Every man. Is Christ the source? Is he the boss of every man? Well, a lot of men don't take any orders from Christ. They're not Christians. But Christ is the head of every man. And the man is the head of a woman. And God is the head of Christ. God is the head of Christ. Now, I want to ask the question. If head means ruler, if head means boss, if head means dictator, if head means, then you're saying God, that's God the Father, is the head of Christ. And by the way, there were many arguments in the church and in the philosophers and early church history of people who said, if you're saying that Jesus Christ is totally subject to the Father, if you say that, you are insulting Christ, because the two are one, right? In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, he was in the beginning with God, and Jesus said in John chapter 10, I think it's in verse 30, that the Father and I are one. One. Not two, but one. So what does this mean? What are we talking about head? Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ. So I'm going to explore this in depth. We'll talk